Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Trump administration has gone after the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, from lots of angles. Now it's issued two new rules, effective the moment the ink dried, saying that women employees won't get coverage for contraceptives if their employers don't like contraception on religious or moral grounds. This hour on Point, the Trump administration, church, state, and contraception. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you get coverage of contraceptives through your insurance at work? Might that go away in your workplace? What do you think of that? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will talk contraceptives and religious freedom, as the Trump administration puts it, in just a moment. But first, today the president is going with another move against his predecessor's signature health care law, issuing an executive order to loosen regulations on how businesses insure their workers. Jonathan Cohn joins us to explain. He is senior national correspondent covering healthcare for the Huffington Post, joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Jonathan Cohn, thanks very much for being with us. What is this move allowing people to get healthcare through associations? What's going on, Jonathan?
Right. So there's a lot of moving pieces here, but the basic idea is to loosen some of the rules that have been put in place on insurance and allow the growth of kind of a second, almost parallel market for health insurance, where there would be plans that wouldn't necessarily comply with the regulations that are now in place that Obamacare put in place. So, for example, there would be these short-term plans that wouldn't have all the essential benefits like maternity care and mental health. And if you had a pre-existing condition, they could decline coverage or charge you more money for these plans. Now, because these plans cover less and they don't cover people with big medical problems, they'll be cheaper, and they're going to be an attractive option, particularly for people who are in good health and, you know, frustrated with what they're paying today. And that's the big, you know, the big selling point you hear from the administration. These are more choices. These are more options. And, well, you know, that's true. The two problems are, number one, if you get one of these plans and you get sick, you're going to be in trouble because they're not going to have all the coverage that you get today, and you might get medical bills and discover the policy doesn't pay for them. But really the bigger danger over the long term for the whole program is that there's a danger that you're drawing away kind of, you know, who's going to go to these plans? People in good health already. You draw those people out of the Affordable Care Act, out of the exchanges. And the plans that are left there, insurance companies are like, uh-oh, we don't have enough, we don't have enough healthy people paying in premiums to cover the costs of people with big medical bills. They have to raise rates. They have to pull out. This is something we've obviously seen to some extent already. The worry is that this executive order today, when it's fully carried out, will make that problem a lot worse.
Who would be able to do this? I mean, we're talking about association health plans, among other things here, but what is that? Like, who could band together to offer these lighter, I don't know, skimpier, depending how you look at it, plans, cheaper?
Right. So there's sort of two categories of plans here. The association plans are typically offered by regular insurance companies, but they are marketed through an association. Now, and it could be an association of realtors. It could be the local chamber of commerce. One of the questions here is just how easy will it be to join one of these associations? Is it only for small businesses, or is it also for people who, you know, are single people, sort of self-employed?
Could it be an association of marathon runners?
So, you know, this is one of the questions that comes up. The joke that people, you know, I don't know if a joke is the right word, but, you know, critics of these, of this idea say, well, you could have an association of mouth breathers, you know.
but I mean, it could be an association of people who are very healthy by kind of definition and therefore could get very low rates?
So this is a worry. I mean, this is the sort of extreme worry in this case. It is worth mentioning that we do, you know, to do all of this, you know, they can't, this is not passing a law. We're not getting something through Congress here. This is purely by executive order. This is the Trump administration just saying this is how, you know, things are going to be. To do that, that means they have to live within the constraints that are placed there by existing laws. And one of the important laws at work here, there's a big law that covers all large employer plans called ERISA. And it's pretty specific about who qualifies and who doesn't. So it's possible that the Trump administration will say, yeah, you know, if you're a marathon runner, you can join an association. And for precisely the reason you suggest, that would be a, you know, that would be a bad idea for the system as a whole. But if they tried that, there's a decent, I'd say actually a good chance somebody would sue in court and say, wait, you can't do that. And probably, but not definitely, the courts would say, yeah, you can't go that far. It's got to be an association of that makes a little more sense than the Association of Marathon Runners.
The president moving here by executive order, Republicans have been fiercely critical of President Obama, fiercely critical for years because he moved on health care by executive order. What's the president say about taking that path now?
Yeah, funny that, right? I mean, it wasn't that long ago we were hearing about abuses of executive power and how awful it was. I mean, look,
you can make that argument, but if you make it one way, what about the other way?
Well, you can. I mean, you know, this is hypocrisy. To be fair, I think you often see that case. I mean, when a party is out of power and they when you don't have the presidency, then you start to raise concerns about executive power. When you do have the presidency, then you're very excited about executive power. But again, I mean, there are limits that the law puts in place, and you know, there's a court system to uphold them. So I assume the Trump administration is going to push as hard as it can to stretch the limits of executive authority to go as far in this direction as they can on their own. And then it will be up to the courts at some point to sort of step in and say, wait a minute, you can't do that. But obviously, you know, that depends on, you know, who the judges are and who the courts are, and you never know how that's going.
This will have ramifications, you're saying, though, for everyone. I mean, if you get an association, that's one path. If you don't, your rates may go up even more because these things are being carved out by the Trump administration here.
Right. It will certainly reverberate, I think, you know, again, depending how far this all goes, and they're just starting the process of writing these rules, you know, you could see a scenario where it affects everybody buying insurance on their own and every small business because it would affect those markets. Whether it eventually filters into the markets for people who have insurance from large employers, which is how most Americans get private insurance, that's kind of a separate question. But certainly for small businesses, for people buying coverage on their own, which today, you know, might mean through healthcare.gov or Covered California, what have you, yes, this could have very far-reaching implications.
Jonathan Cohn is senior national correspondent covering healthcare for The Huffington Post, with us today from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, back to health insurance coverage for contraceptives. That's our main subject in this hour. Joining me first today from Washington is Emma O'Connor. She covers reproductive policy and politics for BuzzFeed. You can find a link to her recent reporting on all this at our website, onpointradio.org. Emma, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
This almost got blown away in news coverage by everything else that's been going on this week. But last Friday, steps were taken on this front of who will cover what when it comes to contraceptives. Can you tell us what has happened, Emma?
Yeah. So on Friday, a much-anticipated two rules dropped from HHS. They're called interim final rules. And they said that any employer with a moral or religious objection to providing contraception for their employees could just stop without alerting the government. So while I think that a lot of people online have think that this just means a total rollback for Obamacare's contraception mandate, it's mostly just for places that have expressed opposition to providing contraception in the past.
Well, is that true, Emma? Moral grounds? We know there's been religious opposition here, and some religious organizations and colleges associated with them have not wanted to cover contraceptives. But isn't there a new angle to this? If you just say moral objection, how confining is that? How narrowly is that defined?
Yes, absolutely. The moral objection. So the religious objection part is the one that's more standard. It's the one that was expected. The moral objection is more of a wild card in exactly what you're saying. It's so the only stipulations in the interim final rule, which went into effect as soon as they were published. says that any company or organization with a sincerely held, those are the words, sincerely held moral opposition to contraception can just stop providing it. So
how do they test that sincerity?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we don't know.
Is there a test?
And that's what we will find out. There is not a test as
of now. There's no test. And they don't even have to inform the government that they're dropping the coverage.
They don't have to inform the government. So the test would only come if the organization is sued by an employee or a dependent who wishes to provide to have contraception coverage.
Emma, when this came out, the Department of Health and Human Services says this would affect a very small number of people. They said no more than 120,000 women would lose contraception coverage under this rule. Now, some 50-plus million covered by it now. Is that true, that it would be that small? Do we know that?
We don't know that right now, but there have been studies that kind of say the opposite. There was a study in October in 2017 that showed that 11% out of, I think it was around 600 larger organizations would drop contraception coverage given the option.
And are there restrictions on who can drop it? I mean, can like publicly traded firms, big companies, can they drop it?
So publicly traded corporations can't drop it under the moral. So if they are closely held, which means that they have basically it's a small number of shareholders, then they can receive accommodations. This was a Supreme Court decision under Obama with the Hobby Lobby case. But publicly traded companies cannot take advantage of the moral exemption.
But I'm not sure about that. It says for a for-profit entity that is not closely held, including publicly traded companies.
Is that under the religious one or under the moral one?
Well, I mean, they're both going to be in effect here. Nonprofit mm-hmm. organizations, a closely held for-profit entity, a for-profit entity that is not closely held, including publicly traded companies or any other non-governmental employer, I'm reading here, right. Along with institutions of higher education. That sounds like a pretty broad swath of companies that would be able to do this.
It is. And there are a lot of state laws that actually prevent that from happening. And they usually pertain to publicly traded corporations. So I think the argument that was made by HHS on Friday to press in a phone call was that there are a lot of state laws that would prevent that from happening. But again, we have yet to see whether that's the case.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom. Just a quick message before we get back to the show. I'm inviting you to stick around at the end of this podcast for an excerpt from another NPR show, Only a Game. Here's why. This weekend, Only a Game is examining power and corruption at the NCAA after the FBI arrested 10 people, including 4 college basketball coaches, for allegedly accepting bribes. College players and their families are vulnerable. Listen for a sneak preview of Only a Game's episode, Power, Money, and Corruption, the Exploitation of College Athletes, at the end of our show. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the new Trump administration policy allowing employers to drop coverage of contraceptives on religious or moral grounds. Trump letting employers take contraceptive coverage off the table. You can join us this hour. Have you been following this? Is this a reasonable exemption for employers who have religious or moral objections? Or is this giving too much government-supported leverage to one particular view? And where does this end? Will we let employers off the hook for vaccinations, hip replacements, tonsils out if they object to those? It was last Friday. President Trump talked with reporters in the White House Rose Garden. Here he is, quoting, invoking Thomas Jefferson to explain the new rules on insurance coverage for contraceptives.
For too long, the federal government has used the power of the state as a weapon against people of faith, bullying and even punishing Americans for following their religious beliefs. It's been happening.
And here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying not much about limiting contraception coverage, but framing all this in the new rules as about freedom of religion.
The president believes that the freedom to practice one's faith is a fundamental right in this country, and I think all of us do. And that's all that today was about. Our federal government should always protect that right.
Not everybody thinks that's all it's about. Here's Democratic Representative Jackie Speier of California talking with the NBC affiliate in D.C., expressing outrage over the Trump rules on contraception now.
I'm flummoxed, really, by the disregard they have for women. I think it would be interesting to allow employers now to withdraw coverage for Viagra on moral grounds.
Not happening yet anyway. Does this affect you? Is your workplace changing its rules after this move by the Trump administration? We're at 800-423-8255. Emma O'Connor covers health reproductive policy and politics for BuzzFeed and is with us from Washington. Also with us from Washington right now, Ashley McGuire. She's a senior fellow with the Catholic Association, a founding editor of AltFem. It's a web magazine focused on faith and gender, author of Sex Scandal, The Drive to Abolish Male and Female. Ashley McGuire, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hey, Tom. It's great to be with you.
And with us from Washington, Gretchen Borschelt. She is Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center. The NWLC will be filing a lawsuit in the next few days against the Trump administration's new rules. Gretchen Borschelt, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Ashley, how do you see what has just unfolded here?
I think I share the opinion of other groups that have been waiting for this for a long time. I think we thought from the get-go that this was a totally unnecessary fight, that if the government wants to make sure that all women have access to contraception, they can do so in a way without violating the religious beliefs of groups like the Little Sisters of the Poor. And I think it's important to realize that this does not, as many people are saying, roll back the contraceptive mandate. What it does is simply broaden the exemption, the religious liberty exemption, in the prior mandate.
I mean, it does. Wait, there won't be coverage if I work for an organization that doesn't want to give it. That sounds like a rollback to me, Ms. McGuire.
No, but it's still requiring employers to provide contraception in their plans. It just broadens the exemption for those who have religious or moral exemptions to doing so.
Right.
So really what it's going to do is, if you're Notre Dame University, the Little Sisters of the Poor, or another group like that, you're off the hook.
Exactly. I mean, but that, to me, that sounds like a rollback. The Obama administration and the Affordable Care Act already came in and said, look, if you have moral objections to this, we won't require you to pay for that coverage. That'll be paid for under the Affordable Care Act by the government. What was wrong with that, to your mind, Ashley McGuire?
Because they still required these groups to provide the coverage in their plans. It required them to work with their HR departments to make sure that their employees knew that this was part of their plans. So they were still complicit in it. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think if you have a group like the Little Sisters of the Poor saying this violates our religious beliefs, shouldn't we err on the side of the conscience rights of a group like them? I mean, the idea that they went into this looking for a several years long Supreme Court battle is absurd. I think this was very much a political fight that the government started. It was unnecessary. And again, I think to go back to the spirit of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the idea here is that if the government has a compelling policy goal, which according to the government, the policy goal here is to make sure that all women have access to contraceptives,
yeah,
they must do it in a way that least restricts the religious beliefs of the citizens.
Would you?
And
mm-hmm. Sorry.
They failed to do so.
Would you just articulate for us with the Catholic Association and others who brought a suit here, what is the objection to making contraceptives available? What's your objection to contraception?
No, I don't think they're – I think groups that have been fighting this mandate are not objecting to that policy goal. I think they're neutral. I mean, it's a mix of groups you have.
But you don't want to do it. Why not?
No. Again, you have a mix of groups. You have people who are perfectly fine with contraceptives. You have groups and companies that only had a problem with the abortifacient part of the contraceptives. But nobody from the get-go, even the bishops' conference has been very clear. Nobody is opposing the idea of that particular government policy. They just don't want to be forced to be complicit in it and think very reasonably that there's a way the government can make sure that women get... We already spend billions of dollars providing contraceptives to low-income women. Isn't there a way that for these sliver of groups that oppose this mandate on religious grounds, isn't there a way the government can make sure that those women can get what they need without involving directly...
I get that.
Universities, but charities.
Yes, I get that. But these groups are not objecting to ensuring hip replacements or, vaccinations. But they are objecting to ensuring contraception. And I'm asking you why this particular objection. What is the objection to ensuring contraception?
Well, I think it depends who you ask. If you were to ask Hobby Lobby, their only issue was with abortifacients, with drugs whose own FDA label says it can destroy an embryo. That to them is tantamount to being complicit in an abortion. If you were to ask the Little Sisters of the Poor, I mean, we can get into, what Catholic doctrine says about this issue. But at issue here, again, to step back and look at the religious
freedom. I don't
want
to step all the way back because these are women who have had insurance coverage for contraception and now they won't. Among all the other health coverage, and I would like to, if you could continue just to articulate why contraception is being singled out here. And it's not just abortifacients. It's all contraception.
Well, I mean, first of all, they never did. I mean, the mandate was never
actually enforced. Well, that's exactly what this policy is. No, now. That's
right. So
they won't be required to cover contraception. I'm asking why. Why this particular thing?
Well, I mean, I think it's no secret that there's plenty of Christian and religious groups, not just Christian groups, but Christians in America who are opposed to either contraceptives or abortions or, I mean, the original mandate also included things like sterilizations. I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, it's what their religious beliefs are. And we have a longstanding tradition in this country of not forcing people to violate their religious beliefs, especially when it comes to health care issues.
Gretchen Borschelt, how do you see what's happened here just now?
Well, I think we have to remember there's a longstanding tradition in this country as well of not forcing one person's religious beliefs on someone else. And that's what this rule really does. So it says there's one religious view here that we're going to prioritize, and we're going to allow employers to have their religious views override what their employees need. They need for their health conditions. They need to plan and prevent pregnancies and their own religious beliefs, right? So an employee's religious beliefs are basically ignored here and overridden by their boss. That is just unacceptable in this country. That's one of the reasons we're going to be filing a lawsuit against this rule. We know that hundreds of thousands of women are going to be affected by it. The numbers that they tried to put forward in the rule were just faulty and really underestimated the impact that we think this rule is going to have. And we know that women are scared. We've heard from them already. They are really worried about losing this coverage that's been essential to them. They do not know how they're going to find and afford birth control on their own.
How wide do you see under this new circumstance, what breadth of employers could take advantage of this?
Look, we know that right now 62.4 million women have this coverage. This rule lets any employer get out of providing it for any religious or moral reason. Any employer, it's pretty much the entire American workforce right now, has the ability to object to providing birth control coverage. And opening up to moral objections, who knows where that could go? There could be employers who try and hide cost concerns behind moral objections. There's no certification process. There's no special notice that any of these employers have to provide. So we just don't know how wide this is going to go. We already know there have been hundreds of employers who have filed suit against this requirement. So at least those are going to be objecting. That's tens of thousands of employees already. We don't know how much bigger it's going to go.
Ashley McGuire, if on this path, and I get the argument you're making, and I know people feel strongly about it, at the same time in this country we've had a kind of live and let live view of life. You know, there are some religions that don't condone any medical intervention, or only in the rarest circumstance, Christian Scientists, let's say. I mean, how far could this way of looking at the world go? Denying insurance, medical insurance entirely because you don't believe in that? On religious grounds, you prefer prayer?
No. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that, suddenly we're going to start having this tidal wave of people invoking religious beliefs for denying this, that, or the other thing.
I mean, why not, is my question. I mean, if that is the ground
here. Because it hasn't happened yet.
The Trump administration is very clear that this is about religious freedom that they're responding to. So you know, your concern, or in this case, the concern is contraception, but why couldn't it go elsewhere?
Look, I think if they saw the ruling in Hobby Lobby and thought, oh, great, suddenly I can stop covering this, that, or the other thing, you would have seen it by now. And I think, again, we have to remember that the companies and the charities and the religious organizations that have been fighting this lawsuit, I mean, that's really where you're going to see the impact. And these, they've already been granted a number of exceptions at the court level throughout the country. The idea that suddenly there's going to be a tidal wave of companies that are going to stop providing contraceptives in their plans is just false. I mean, you think Amazon is suddenly going to announce that they're going to stop? I mean,
I'm just looking at where it goes for intellectual consistency. I mean, in the Hobby Lobby case, and Gretchen, I'll put this to you, you had Justice Alito in that case. And he emphasized when they came down that, look, okay, Hobby Lobby won't have to pay for this, but there's a workaround here because it'll still be paid for. Their employees can still get birth control coverage. Now, I mean, I'm reading Linda Greenhouse in the Times today. She says the Trump administration has played the Supreme Court justices for chumps because now there isn't a workaround and there isn't coverage. Is this in the spirit of the Hobby Lobby decision by the Supreme Court, Gretchen?
No, absolutely not. So that's a really important point. Religious employers like churches and other houses of worship already had an exemption to providing this birth control benefit. And other nonprofits or for-profits like Hobby Lobby that had religious objections, they had a workaround. So they didn't have to provide birth control coverage. They didn't have to provide it directly. They didn't have to tell their employees about it. They were hands off. On the other hand, the insurance companies had to provide it directly to the employees. So the insurance companies handled it themselves. And that was a system that respected religious beliefs, but still made sure that women got their critical birth control coverage. That's what the Supreme Court approved in Hobby Lobby. That's what the Supreme Court approved just in 2016 in a case called Zubik. And what the Trump administration has done is really violated the Supreme Court's order. It said you must find a way to respect religious beliefs, but still make sure women get seamless birth control coverage. That is not what this does. This takes coverage away from women.
Ashley McGuire, Gretchen Borschelt, Emma O'Connell. Let's go to our listeners. Eileen in Hartford, Connecticut. Eileen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. This is not about religious rights. This is about health care for women. And if you think about the fact that a healthy woman is able to get pregnant over a 35-year span, and she doesn't have good health, good birth control, what are the chances of her having an unwanted pregnancy? And the additional hypocrisy is that we pay millions and millions and millions of dollars for men so that they can have erectile dysfunction drugs. Our military pays millions for men who have served to get erectile dysfunction drugs.
Would you deny them those drugs, Eileen?
No. My argument is that they have the full ability to engage in an intimate life,
yep,
and without birth control, women are denied the exact same right.
Got it. I've got it, and I hear it, and I appreciate your call, Eileen. Let's get one more. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Tom, contraception in this country is pretty inexpensive and readily available. If you go to any college health desk, they'll have a whole basket of free prophylactics. So this whole battle really is very symbolic. And I think the ACA, in a number of ways, including this, is really not trying to provide women something they cannot afford, but is trying to change social mores and assert the power of the federal government over the religious people in society. And
what about Eileen's? I got it, Stephen. We'll look at that. And it's an interesting point. What about Eileen's point earlier? Women may be fertile for 35 years, and right, here you're taking away their capacity that men are given when we cover Viagra to just go on.
Well, I don't want to get into the Viagra business, but listen, Tom, if someone has an infected...
Pretty profitable business, Steve, I think.
Well, it may be, but if someone has infected tonsils or an arthritic hip, that is a medical need. The idea of preventing pregnancy so a woman can enjoy sexual intercourse, that's not a medical need.
Well, it could be. It could be. But how many times would you like to be pregnant in your life if you were a woman, Steve?
Well, Tom, if contraception is inexpensive and readily available everywhere,
yeah,
Why should the ACA pay for it?
Got it, Steve. I appreciate it. Our time's short before the break. Gretchen Borschelt, inexpensive, available everywhere. And this is cultural strong-arming. This is not health care, Steve says.
So it's absolutely not true that contraception is cheap and available. So think about the IUD. That's one of the most effective forms of birth control. Yeah. That upfront cost for an IUD is close to $1,000. That is a full month's salary for a minimum wage worker. Mm-hmm. To say that that person can afford that or won't have to make sacrifices in order to get that birth control, which may be the right birth control for them, is just not understanding the reality of people's lives. That is why birth control was required to be covered here, because when a panel of experts looked at the evidence of women's health and the gaps in coverage, they identified birth control as a real problem, that women couldn't afford it, they couldn't afford to get the more effective long-acting methods, and they were making decisions based on cost. That's what this was meant to remedy.
Ashley, do you feel like the government has been trying to strong-arm employers into a certain cultural view of the world, sexuality, contraception?
I'm very confident that we can find a way for the government to provide these sorts of drugs and devices to women without conscripting religious believers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new Trump policy allowing employers to drop coverage of contraceptives on religious or moral grounds. President Trump letting employers take contraceptive coverage off the table. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Is this a reasonable exemption for employers who have religious or moral objections? Or is this giving too much government-supported leverage to one particular view? And what about women's health and health coverage? Should we be carving out contraceptives? I mean, reproduction is right there at the center of women's health, of course. Emma O'Connor is here. She covers reproductive policy for BuzzFeed. Ashley McGuire is here, senior fellow with the Catholic Association. Gretchen Borschelt is here from the National Women's Law Center. Let's go to Elizabeth, calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Elizabeth, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. First of all, I wanted to say that the whole idea of this administration having any legislation or even executive order having to deal with anything moral is a joke. That being said, this drive to prevent women from getting contraception is also a joke. How do these religious employers not understand that if they allow for birth control, it will prevent conception, which will then prevent abortions? It's the most ridiculous thing. This is punishing women for being able to bear children. If any man had to go through that, you can bet that it would be fully funded and there would be no arguments.
Elizabeth, stick with us in Omaha. Ashley McGuire, what do you say to our caller from Omaha?
Well, I mean, I'd say it better to avoid going into the nitty-gritty of how contraception works and whether it all prevents conception or not.
What did you just say? You were raising questions about whether contraception prevents inception?
Conception.
Is that what you're asserting?
Sure. So you have some of the contraception that was at issue here does not prevent conception. It destroys a fertilized egg, so an embryo. So, for example, that was at the crux of the issue with the Hobby Lobby case. Those drugs are abortifacient. And the owners of Hobby Lobby, who are Christians and still own their business, did not want to pay for and provide in their plans abortion drugs. And again, I think that we have a longstanding tradition in this country of not requiring employers and people generally in the healthcare profession.
This is much broader than that. And that's what Elizabeth's pointing to. What about her? I mean, this is all contraceptives are not required to be covered here, this exemption
scheme. Tom, may I jump in here, really? I feel like there's actually a misunderstanding going on here because the definition of abortifacients and abortion drugs is different for different groups. So I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of Catholic organizations, and this is nitty gritty, but believe that.
Fine.
That life begins at conception, and conception begins when the sperm goes into the egg, but before it implants into the wall of the uterus. A lot of doctors and most other groups and a lot of other religions, including Presbyterians, believe that pregnancy and life begins when it attaches to the uterine lining, because a lot of women can eject a fertilized egg in their periods without realizing it.
So there's an argument right there, but it's fair to say that this rule, Emma, covers all contraception.
It does. So IUDs, the argument from a lot of Catholic organizations and pro-life organizations is that IUDs are abortifacients because they can sometimes prevent, get rid of a fertilized egg before it implants in the wall, and therefore it's destroying life.
Elizabeth, you're listening in Omaha. What are you making of this?
I think this caller is an idiot. If you get the, well, this idiot and or this caller and that caller.
These are our guests in the studio in Washington, not callers. You're the caller, and we're happy you're calling. But what do you think, Elizabeth?
Yes, but I think if you this whole thing that about contraception pre-aborting a fertilized egg, if you give women the access to prevent the eggs from maturing enough to reach it, you know, to the point where the stupid sperm is going to hit the egg, you would not be aborting a fertilized egg. I don't understand this. You're trying to prevent women from conceiving at all. That's the whole point of birth control.
Elizabeth, we've got it, and you're looking at the whole course of reproductive life here. Let me get one more, if I may. Alice in Charlestown, Massachusetts. Alice, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Tom. Mm-hmm. I'm calling with a slightly different question. As a young woman around 12 years old, I was diagnosed with severe ovarian cysts, and I was actually prescribed, for medical reasons, contraceptives, very low hormonal level contraceptives to help control ovarian cysts and cycle issues. And I was wondering, this hasn't really been discussed, how this would be handled. Would that not be allowed anymore? And, you know, as a young woman who is 12 dealing with these problems,
yeah.
It's something I would definitely be worried about for my future children because it runs in our family.
I appreciate your call, Alice. Gretchen, this is, for many women, this is not just about preventing pregnancy.
That's right. We know a quarter of women are using birth control for health reasons. And what's so offensive about this rule, other than the fact that it exists and would take birth control coverage away from women, is it actually says there's no requirement on employers to provide birth control coverage if it's needed for health reasons. So you don't have to be providing that birth control coverage if somebody needs it for health reasons in the first place. You already get out of that according to this rule.
Chaz in Tampa, Florida. Chaz, thank you for calling. You're on.
Thank you, Tom, for taking this call. Mm-hmm. I don't think this conversation should devolve into calling people idiots.
I agree. But I entirely agree, Chase.
Even people of majorly differing points. But my point is, I cannot believe that anybody believes that you need to force anybody, employer or otherwise, to provide birth control for anybody. Believe it or not, sex is still an elective, you know, thing that people do. And if you want to,
so you're saying don't have sex, Chaz? And that's, isn't it part of life?
Does it? Yes, it's part of life. But also, the consequences of having sex, meaning producing a baby, is not your responsibility. It's not my employer's responsibility. This is the person who engages in responsibility.
Well, yes, but aren't contraceptives all about taking responsibility for those consequences, Chaz? Isn't that exactly what, and even socially, you know?
But here's the problem, that you use the argument that this is a live and let live society, culture, America.
Why? Well, it's not a theocracy, and we celebrate that. We have a separation of church and state. That's true.
Okay, yes, but that's the separation of church and state is not forcing employers to do things that they find morally objective. That's the separation of church and state. So if somebody finds it morally objective, whether it's a Catholic organization or even an owner of a business that happens to be Catholic or any religion that doesn't want to provide birth control, why are they forced to provide it? In fact, I suggest that person that has to have birth control provided should get a job where they provide it.
Well,
that's up to that person.
We got it. Emma O'Connor, could this create a situation where when you go in for a job interview, a prospective employee should now say, not only ask about, you know, I don't know, pay and vacation time, but ask about, reproductive coverage, contraceptive coverage?
Yeah, I think that making that assumption comes from a very privileged place. A lot of people don't really have a choice about where they work, especially if they're in a religious community where a lot of the places have opted out of this, or if they're a student at a Catholic university, and maybe when they went there when they were 18, they didn't consider their college choice based on whether or not they would want their birth control covered.
Let's go to Eli in Des Moines. Eli, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually a Christian minister here in Des Moines. And from somebody who's actually studied theology, religious ethics, this is not a moral or religious issue. It really isn't. It comes down to a political stunt aimed at gaining points politically with a certain group of people. People who have actually studied spiritual issues know that this is not a moral or religious issue.
Well, not to you, but what if somebody else says it is to me, Eli?
That's a perfectly subjective argument, but for it to come into the political sphere, for it to be an issue of law, I feel like that's an unfair position for the administration to take.
Now, what if, but Ashley McGuire says, look, this does offend some people's sense of what's correct according to their religion, and government should not be doing that. What if it did offend your sense of religious rectitude, Eli?
Well, I suppose that would be an example of politics and politicians using offense to push agenda issues and using offense and not science, not medicine, not genuine, legitimate arguments, I don't think is a basis for making policy.
What do you mean when you say this comes down to scoring political points?
Well, it's a long-held, I think, assumption that many Christians fall on one side of the political spectrum, that most Christians would vote Republican and Republican only, and that just isn't true. That to push these kinds of issues is trying to play to a base that probably isn't as big as people think, but that isn't the only opinion, that there are plenty of people with religious and moral positions that don't align with the conservative agenda.
Eli, I appreciate your call from Des Moines. Emma O'Connor, take us into a little bit of how this this policy came to be, how the sausage was made here. I'm reading in here Christianity Today that this policy was largely shaped, I'm quoting here, by former Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF legal counsel Matthew Bowman, who is now a lawyer with the Department of Health and Human Services. He, again, quoting Christianity Today, Bowman represented March for Life in the Hobby Lobby case. So he was on the Hobby Lobby team. Now he's inside the government, the administration. Who's Matthew Bowman and what's his background here, Emma?
As you said, his background is that he was a lawyer for March for Life, a pro-life organization that has an annual March for Life, anti-abortion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He was on their case. He defended them. He brought it to the Supreme Court. And they actually won in a district court under his guidance. And now he's really high up in HHS legal counsel. It's been reported and told to me that he was one of the main architects of these rules, along with Katie Talento, who has also been very vocal in the past about being anti-contraception and anti-abortion. And she is now a White House advisor.
Julie in Des Moines, Iowa. Julie, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Des Moines is all over the place with us today, Julie. Thank you for calling.
We are, yes. I just want to say I've heard the word moral and objection, and as a Christian, I consider myself a contemplative Christian. God gave us sexuality for a joy, delight, and for me the fundamental issue is how are people viewing sexuality and who has the right to have sex and enjoy it?
Julie, hold the thought. We're looking at this new policy on contraception coverage. Ashley McGuire with the Catholic Association, how do you respond to Julie in Des Moines?
I mean, I think my only response would be the same point that I keep making, which is that the only issue that groups like mine and other plaintiffs have had from the beginning is that setting aside the public policy goal that the government put forward, our only issue is religious believers should not be forced to violate their consciences when it comes to this. And we've argued from the beginning, and I continue to believe, that there is a way for the government to, in the spirit of RFRA, which was a bill, by the way, that was introduced by Chuck Schumer, Ted Kennedy, and signed into law by Bill Clinton, there is a way to advance that public policy goal without forcing religious believers to violate their most deeply held beliefs. That's the only argument we've ever made.
Julie, what would you say to that? She, you know, Ashley just doesn't want those to be conscience to be violated.
But that doesn't address how do you look at sexuality. I mean, it seems to me that you're seeing it as something that's just limited to having children. Is it good? Is it bad? It's marvelous. It's a gift from God for all of us to enjoy. And then when you put call it morally objectionable. I find that really, as a Christian, heartbreaking.
Julie, we've got it. Gretchen Borschelt, what about this, the fundamental argument that Ashley McGuire makes, you know, believers should not be forced to violate their conscience, is how she puts it.
Look, I think the bottom line comes down to the woman, right, who needs this birth control. And an employer may think a certain method of birth control is wrong or may think that a certain method of birth control acts as an abortion, but the woman doesn't. She's using birth control to prevent pregnancy, to try and have sex if she wants to have sex without getting pregnant, to plan or space pregnancies, right? She may already mm-hmm. have kids and decide that she doesn't want to have another one right now. There are a host of reasons that a woman needs birth control. And what matters here, what should matter, is her decision and why she's deciding to use it and the method that she wants to use, not her boss's belief about that.
What does this open up to your mind, Gretchen, in terms of the future? I mean, if we make an exception for contraception, there are other religions who object to other treatments. Does this crack open room for more exemptions in coverage?
I think we're looking at the possibility of a very dangerous slippery slope. We know that there are religious objections to vaccinations. We know that there have been religious objections to services that LGBTQ individuals need. So the worry is that this is opening up a can of worms, and we could see those kinds of objections being raised and then the Trump administration deciding to approve those as well.
What kind of legal challenges do you see coming to this? Do you expect this will take effect and be unchallenged, or what do you see coming, Gretchen?
So there have already been a host of lawsuits filed. We will be filing one in the coming days, but we've already seen a number of groups step forward and a number of state attorneys general. So Pennsylvania, Washington, Massachusetts, California, all of those attorneys generals have come forward to file lawsuits against these rules because they're so dangerous and they are concerned for their residents. And we, along with them, believe we have strong legal claims and that we're going to stop this rule.
Ashley, do you think this is on firm ground here? Do you think it'll hold? It's gone a bit beyond Hobby Lobby. Do you think it'll stand?
Oh, yeah, I think it'll stand. And, you know, I think, again, all we're really doing is restoring religious freedom, the spirit of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act back as the rule of law in this country. It's the way it's been since the inception of the United States of America. The idea of religious freedom is sort of a pluralistic, bipartisan rallying point. And my hope is that we can move beyond this unnecessary culture war and get back to that.
Some say culture war. Some say women's health and women's rights. Contraception's out there. Vice President Mike Pence has 2 children. Jeff Sessions has 3 children. They accomplished that. Emma O'Connor, do you see this going on? Does the fight go on or is it over here right now?
Oh, I think it's definitely going to go on. There's actually a letter from 14 more attorneys general saying that they are ready to take legal action against this. This is definitely not the end.
Watch this space. Emma O'Connor with BuzzFeed. Thank you very much for being with us today, Emma.
Thank you, Tom.
Ashley McGuire at the Catholic Association. Thank you for joining us today, Ashley.
Thanks for having me.
And Gretchen Borschelt at the National Women's Law Center. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your thoughts and input. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is NPR. Hi, it's Tom. Thanks for sticking around for this preview from Only a Game special report, Power, Money, and Corruption, the Exploitation of College Athletes, available this weekend on your NPR station or podcast app.
I'm Bill Littlefield. This week on WBUR and NPR's Only a Game, we dedicate the entire hour to one question. Should college athletes be paid?
Maybe you've heard. Big-time college sports are in trouble.
Well, it's about as bad as it gets. It's not the NCAA knocking on the door, but the FBI.
The FBI is charging 10 people with fraud and corruption.
We all know this system is corrupt. Every one of us knows it.
If there's going to be a death penalty, it needs to be to amateurism. Give amateurism the death penalty, then you have a chance at creating a system free of a lot of this corruption.
But the problems with the NCAA didn't begin on September 26th when those charges were announced.
The story of the NCAA is a story of power, money, and corruption. It's been going on for a long time, and it's the athletes and their families who get hurt.
I wake up in the middle of the night dreaming that I walk in the door and he's hanging. Or he shot himself because he's that depressed. you put trust in these universities. You trust them with your kid on and off the court. And once you're damaged good, they just kick you to the curb.
We've spent the past few months trying to figure out how the NCAA and amateurism went wrong. And can the system be fixed, or does it need to be dismantled?
Why in the world would we have football be a part of a college? What does that have to do with education?
Litigation hasn't worked. Organization hasn't worked. Legislation, there's no way it's going to work. So the only thing that was really left was competition.
I think we are in the midst of the tipping point. The question is, how far will it tip?